exchange, people would be really angry, and they'd overthrow the government. Well, no, look, this is an external enemy that's laid siege to us, you know? This isn't the government. The government has tried many things. Every time he tried one thing, the United States would counter with something else. So this has been, you know, a to and fro. But I must admit, and I must say, that it is good news. It is good news for Venezuela. We went through a period where the inflation at one point, I think, was 129% per month. This was 2019. You can't even imagine what, I mean, right now we say, oh, inflation's gone up 1%. Oh, inflation's gone up 2%, we say here in these countries. Well, this was 191% a month in 2019. But it wasn't just economics. 100,000 Venezuelans at least have died because we could not buy food in the international market. But most of all, we could not buy medicines. You know, if you have cancer, there are these medicines that have been, you know, elaborated in big laboratories. You can't just sort of say, oh, well, we can make the same thing here. They're all patented, so you have to buy them. Well, I myself, one of my very dearest cousins, my first cousin, she died. She had cancer because they could not get the medicine that could have at least deterred that cancer. And like her, there were so many, you know. If you needed insulin, there was no insulin. We celebrated when a huge plane from China arrived full of insulin for the people of Venezuela. If you had AIDS, well, you're dead, because those viral sort of medicines that you can give people who have HIV and keep prolong their life, well, we couldn't get them. But worst of all, and this is something that is hard to forgive, in the middle of a world pandemic, they stopped Moderna and Pfizer from selling vaccines to Venezuela. So Venezuela would not have had vaccines if it wasn't for Russia and China, and then later Cuba, that brought their vaccines to the country. This is unimaginable cruelty. And we have had that with the sanctions.
It is cruelty, and it is criminal as well. And we're going to take a break right here, but I just want to say this about sanctions, that much like oil, any conversation with regards to Venezuelan migrants, without mentioning the impacts of sanctions on Venezuela, is not telling the whole story. Because as you just described, sanctions can kill and has killed in places like Venezuela. I always make the comparison for people who probably remember the 90s of how sanctions adversely affected people in Iraq. You know, before the lead up to the war in 2003, there were economic sanctions in Iraq that led to a lot of deaths from preventable diseases and illnesses because of a lack of access to medicines during the 1990s. Yes. And that was imposed by the United States. And we're seeing it imposed in much the same way in Venezuela today. So we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with Maria Paez Victor. She is a Venezuelan-born sociologist living in Canada. Her recent article in Counterpunch is entitled, Where Are the Defenders of the Human Rights of Venezuelans? This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
Andan de rodillas por dinero, vende patria miles traicioneros, lacayos rastreros del gran invasor.
Traidores,
porque al pueblo siempre lo engañaron, lo burlaron y discriminaron, y lo asesinaron en calles y prisiones.
Y lo son,
porque anhelan con toda su alma ver la bota imperial con sus armas pisándole el alma a nuestra nación.
Y son
sinvergüenzas, malinques, confesos, han perdido el honor y por eso venden por un peso nuestra dignidad.
Traidores.
historia, a esta patria tan llena de gloria, sagrada memoria del libertador.
Traidores,
con su llanto y las canas quedarán, pero ustedes jamás volverán a pisar al pueblo, jamás volverán.
Y lo son,
porque anhelan con toda su alma ver la bota imperial con sus armas pisándole el alma a nuestra nación.
Y son
sinvergüenzas malinques, confesos, han perdido el honor y por eso venden por un peso nuestra dignidad.
Colorín colorado,
Tori la jodienda se les ha acabado.
Colorín, colorín colorado,
volverán el pueblo, se los ha curado.
Colorín colorado,
el pueblo no primero ya se ha liberado.
Colorín, colorín.
That was Los Guaraguao, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone, you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. And, of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking with Maria Paez Victor, who's a Venezuelan-born sociologist living in Canada. Her recent article in Counterpunch is entitled, Where Are the Defenders of the Human Rights of Venezuela? Going back to the Marco Rubio clip that we heard in the first half of the show, he mentioned something about Venezuelans being greeted as heroes when they return to Venezuela, which is another one of his ways of demonizing Venezuelan migrants, assuming that the government in Venezuela is greeting terrorists or however he describes it. But in your article, there is a program called Return to the Homeland. I wonder if you could explain this for people who don't know, because this is something else that's been left off the narrative when it comes to, at the very least, humanizing migrants, mm-hmm. whether it be Venezuelan or otherwise.
We have a wonderful poet that in about 1890, I think it was, or maybe it was 1900, wrote a beautiful poem called Vuelta a la Patria. It's about a man who has gone away from Venezuela, and then after many years, he comes back. He comes back, and it's sad because his mother and father are dead, but he is so happy to return home. So what the government has done, and I don't know any other country in the world who would have done this, after all these migrants went to these right-wing countries, Colombia, Peru, Ecuador, Chile, because this was a campaign. These countries collaborated with La Machado and Borges and to tell these people, go to these countries, you know, you will have a nice life there. Of course, they didn't have any nice life there because none of these countries had any kind of program for them to come and find a job or be rehabilitated so that they could get a job there or anything. Many of them were living on the street, but most of all, they suffered from xenophobia. The people in those countries were really angry at them, okay? So the government of President Maduro said any Venezuelan that wants to return to his home, we will help them. And he sent big planes, Venezuelan planes, to these countries, and all the people had to do was go to a consulate and said, I want to go home. That's all they had to do. They didn't have to pay a single cent. They just said, I want to go home. And so these planes have been coming, and you know, hundreds and hundreds of them have come back from Venezuela. I'm sorry I don't have the exact number here, but just this week it was about 150 arrived in one of those planes. And so Maduro has also said, we will send our planes to the United States. You don't have to pay for them. We will bring them home. And so this is the Vuelta a la Patria program. I want to tell you something about Mr. Rubio and the kind of person he is. A despicable person, because he was the one who, when this Venezuelan mother, holding her 1.5-year-old baby girl, was about to enter one of these planes to go home, he had the baby torn from her arms. A little girl. The mother went hysterical, crazy. She was shoved into the plane, and she had to go to Venezuela. And the whole country was absolutely going crazy over, return this baby, return this baby. It was this week that this little girl, after almost, I don't know how many months and months, she was shoved from one foster home to another. The mother did not know where she was. And it was through the good offices of Mr. Richard Grinnell, who had been a man that was sent to Venezuela to do an exchange of prisoners. It was through him. He got to speak to Trump, and they also spoke to the United Nations. And it was through this Mr. Grinnell that this baby was returned home this week. So I have absolutely no respect for Marco Rubio. And to listen to his lies, a man who has never been to Venezuela, who has no way to know what the Tenderagua is, all he said was a bunch of lies. When these people come back from Venezuela in these planes, especially the ones who have escaped the United States and come home, sure enough, the people are happy and they clap and they say, wonderful, they've come back. But that isn't all. They are also given a very deep interrogation by the authorities, by the Minister of Justice and his people. And through that, they have discovered some people who were wanted in Venezuela because they were thieves or something like that. And those that were wanted, well, they go to the courts. You know, they're taken there. Not all of them, but there have been, you know, you have a load of 50 people, and then maybe two or three maybe were wanted or, you know, had something to do with the. But none of them are the Tenderagua, because there is no Tenderagua, okay? This is the big lie. So Marco Rubio is banking. He's banking on a reputation to want to even really now overthrow the government of Maduro. I don't know how he's going to do it. Who's going to overthrow the government of Maduro? Has he got the, you know, an army that's going to do it? Because the army in Venezuela is completely loyal. And so I don't know what his game is.
Yeah, we did a whole show on Marco Rubio as well in his position as Secretary of State. And in my opinion, I totally agree with you. He is Fulgencio Batista reincarnated right now in this Trump administration. Now, I have to say that as the son of Salvadoran immigrants, we can't have this conversation without mentioning Nayib Bukele, the current authoritarian president of El Salvador, and the absurd position that he has taken in this whole criminal scheme of demonizing Venezuelan migrants. And this past April, it was reported that he had gone so far to propose like a prisoner exchange. That's the polite way to say it. A prisoner exchange, which is more like extortion of Venezuelan migrants in the Secaut prison, you know, obviously for money, but also in exchange for political prisoners in Venezuela. You'll forgive me. I'm a little embarrassed to ask you this, but last time I checked, Venezuela's not at war with El Salvador. And so this proposal, at first glance, is pretty absurd for the president of El Salvador to ask for political prisoners, Venezuelan political prisoners, quote unquote, to be released in exchange for Venezuelan migrants who have, up to this point, have no criminal records and no due process as well. And at first glance, I say, because Nayib Bukele does have a public relations background, and he has had relations with right-wing Venezuelans who have helped him with regards to his media relations. Mm-hmm. So there is something under the surface, but that doesn't take away the absurdity of him acting as a deputy here for the Trump administration. I'm curious to get your thoughts on Bukele in this whole criminal scheme here.
He's an embarrassment to Latin America, not just to El Salvador, but he has truly besmirched the heroic, I would say, tradition and history of Latin America, especially Central America, and all of the many people who have given their lives for the dignity and the independence of El Salvador, of Guatemala, of Mexico, of the entire Caribbean and Latin America. I think that he is a man who really, I hate to say this, but he really doesn't have roots in El Salvador. He really doesn't understand his own country and his own history, because if he did, he'd never act like this. So I think he's a very ignorant man, and he is very dangerous, of course, and he has found wonderful partners in the fascist, I say leaders of the opposition of Venezuela, but they're leaders of nothing. These international criminals, which is what I call María Corina Machado and Leopoldo López and Juan Guaidó, they have robbed Venezuela of absolute billions. And by the way, they've also robbed the United States because they received a substantial amount of millions from USAID and pocketed them. USAID is no more, but before it was no more, it acknowledged that the money that they had given to Juan Guaidó, they don't know what happened to it. It was ill spent in terrible things, which I am embarrassed to talk about. But what I want to say is that I think that Bukele's political life is not going to be very long, nor his legacy. I don't think that the people of El Salvador, who have truly suffered immensely during those terrible years, are going to accept this. And I have every hope that his terms will be short and his legacy will be nil in the dustbins of history. I want to say that there are no political prisoners in Venezuela. Everyone who's in a prisoner in Venezuela has gone through a trial and has had the benefit of lawyers. You know, I have to tell you this. Ever since we had a new constitution, that was the grand thing that Hugo Chavez did. When he was elected in the year 1999, he put his hand on the old constitution and he said, I swear on this moribund constitution, this dying constitution, that I will carry on my duties and whatnot. Because his campaign was that we were going to have a new constitution, because the old constitution was created by the elites and all kinds of terrible things in it. So Venezuela had one of the most progressive, it still has, one of the most progressive constitutions in the region for certain. And it was written in ordinary Spanish. It was legalese. You know, sometimes lawyers write in a way that you really don't understand what they're talking about. This was, if you know Spanish, you can read the constitution and you can understand it. Well, the Venezuelan people became real experts on the Constitution. Everybody has a Constitution in a little booklet this big, everybody in their pockets, in their handbags. And so Venezuelans are very legalistic. They will tell you Article so-and-so and Article so-and-so, and they become real legal experts on their own Constitution, which is really hilarious because, you know, in these countries that we live in, you know, you say, oh, the Constitution, people, roll their eyes and say, you know, I haven't read that. But the question of political prisoners in Venezuela is not existent. If there are prisoners, it's because they committed some crime that they went to the judge. There was a trial and they were convicted. So that is not political prisoners. But I also want to say something. Venezuela has never gone to war. The only time that Venezuelan troops have left Venezuela to go to another country was as the Army of Liberation. And it went under Simón Bolívar, and it liberated from the Spanish Empire, Colombia, Ecuador, Bolivia, Peru, and of course Panama didn't exist because it was part of Colombia. So the only time that the Venezuelan army has ever left the country was not against a war against a neighbor. It was against an empire, and it was the Army of Liberation. We have never gone to war, and it's a great sort of pride that we are not an aggressive country that wants to go to war against it. Even now, with what ExxonMobil is trying to do in Guyana, you know, Venezuelans are saying, look, this isn't Guyana doing this. This is ExxonMobil. ExxonMobil has put Guyana in its pocket.
Once again, everything that we've discussed here is a far cry from the corporate media narrative that would give people the impression here in the U.S. that Venezuela is about to take over all of Latin America and take over all of the Western Hemisphere. All this fear and paranoia and exaggeration that is nowhere close to the reality that we discussed during the course of this conversation. What is reality, though, is the demonization of Venezuelan migrants. Even as we have this conversation this week, the Trump administration has stripped the protected status of close to 350,000 migrants, most of them Venezuelans, which unfortunately gives me the impression that this demonization is only going to get worse before it gets any better. And so one of the things I'm going to do with this conversation is to create a Twitter link to your article in Counterpunch so people can learn more, not only about the demonization of Venezuelan migrants, but also the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which you also put in your article as well. And so usually I ask guests, what else do you hope people learn from your recent article? But again, at the same time, it seems like things are only going to get worse before they get any better here in the U.S. with regards to this dehumanization of Venezuelan migrants. And before you answer it, I just want to say this as well, that the Biden administration is equally culpable with this narrative of demonizing Venezuelan migrants, because it didn't start with Trump alone. There are a lot of years and a lot of time before this second Trump administration that set this demonization of Venezuelan migrants in motion.
Yes, you're quite right. It was Obama. It was Obama who said that Venezuela posed a threat to U.S. security. And everybody laughed. Everyone said, what? The Venezuelans are going to go and march on Washington? What is this ridiculous? Everybody thought, what, he's gone crazy. No, the reason he said that was because if there is a threat to the security, then the president of the United States can take all sorts of measures without going to Congress. And this is what, of course, especially what Mr. Trump has done, that he can do all these things because he doesn't have to go to Congress, because he said, oh, they're invading us. The Venezuelans are invading us. Remember when he said that for the migrants were eating pets in somewhere? I mean, they're inventing all of this so that then the president can take all of these measures without going through Congress. This is very dangerous, again, for the United States, because your representatives are in Congress. They represent the people. And if the people are being pushed aside by a president, whichever president, who says, oh, no, look, you know, I'm going to decree this and I'm going to decree that. You have a president who's governing by decree. And so what is happening to the people that you voted for, your representatives in Congress? This is, again, a very dangerous thing for you. But I want to say something to you, that I want to emphasize this. In Venezuela, we don't have a mass of people because the people are all organized. We have what is called communal councils and communes. And that is that any group of people in any local area can become a communal council. And that communal council then is the one to decide the kind of things that that community needs. Like, for example, it needs roads, or it needs water pipes, or it needs a school. And so the communal councils and the communes are the ones that have been very central to the survival of Venezuela. The rural communes are the ones who have fed Venezuela, because from being a country that we needed to buy food, we are now a country that 85% of what we eat is made in Venezuela, is grown in Venezuela, and we are even exporting food. And this has been done not by a government that sort of, you know, plans it and tells people you do this, you do the other. No, these are this grassroots, I would say, network of, we have almost 50,000 communal councils and about 5,000 communes, which are the representatives of the communal councils. And so that has been something that is so beautiful. If any of you go to Venezuela, go visit a communal council, because this is the people in motion. I was talking with the mayor, because the municipality is still there. And so I said to the mayor, well, how does that work, that you're the mayor and you have municipal councils, but at the same time you have the communal councils out there? How do you make decisions? And he said, well, you know, we in the municipality may say, you know, we really need to pave some of the streets because they need to be paved. And the representatives say that. But it's the communal councils who will say what streets are going to be paved. So you see, they at the beginning, they didn't know how to work. But now, after all these years, they really work together very, very well. It is a form of, if you like, of public participation. And nobody is, you know, you don't have to belong to the government party or the opposition party or anything like that. This is truly public participation. Why? Because the Venezuelan democracy is called a participatory democracy. And I want to say one last thing. They used to say that, oh, Cuba is a dictatorship because there are no elections. Actually, there were elections, but this is what they said. there are no elections. And then Venezuela, who has elections practically every year, oh, no, those elections, you know, they don't work. You know, those are not true. Since 1999, we've had 32 elections. The next elections is the end of this month, elections for governors, elections for deputy of the assembly. We have elections for president. The elections have all kinds of parties. I think there's about 35 political parties that are joining in this. There's about 6,000 candidates. And how is that not democracy? How is that not democracy when we have international people, international witnesses going to Venezuela and saying, yes, it was a good election. There was no shenanigans. There was no problem. It all went, actually, it went even better than your elections because in 24 hours we knew who had won. But, you know, it doesn't matter. They will say whatever they want about Venezuela, and Venezuela just says, we're carrying on. We have our government, and we have come out of the tunnel now.
Your passion and conviction and insight to breaking down the false narrative here in the U.S. of not only Venezuela, but Venezuelan migrants is enough to say that we got to have you on the show back again very soon in the near future. And so with that said, we're about out of time. We've been speaking with Maria Paez Victor. She's a Venezuelan-born sociologist living in Canada. Her recent article, Encounter Punch, is entitled, Where Are the Defenders of the Human Rights of Venezuelans? And like I said before, we're going to create a link on our Twitter account so people can read more on this fantastic article. But in the meantime, Maria Paez Victor, it's been insightful and enlightening. Thank you very much for being on the show with us.
Thank you. Un abrazo muy solidario. Muchísimas gracias. Thank you.
Igualmente. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name @LMC_show. And, of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. President Donald Trump took executive action yesterday, making it easier for cities and states to remove unhoused people from the streets. The executive order, titled Ending Crime and Disorder on American Streets, directs federal agencies to find ways to make it easier to forcibly hospitalize unhoused people with mental illness and addiction and for longer periods of time. The order also instructs federal agencies to cut funding for harm reduction and housing programs. Reacting to the order, the National Homelessness Law Center released a statement on why Trump's plan is counterproductive and dangerous at worst. Quote, "The safest communities are those with the most housing and resources, not those that make it a crime to be poor or sick. Forced treatment is unethical, ineffective, and illegal." Close quote. In more news, according to the Wall Street Journal reporting today, the Trump administration is seeking hundreds of millions of dollars from Harvard University in exchange for allowing the school to access federal funding. A White House official told the Journal the $200 million deal that the Trump administration struck with Columbia University on Wednesday is now a blueprint for negotiations with other universities. The Columbia agreement sets out a plan to settle claims over anti-Semitism and prohibit programs that promote what the Trump administration describes as, quote, "unlawful efforts to achieve race-based outcomes," close quote, in student admissions and faculty hiring. In return, the government agreed to unfreeze more than $1 billion in federal grants and funding to the university. The Wall Street Journal reports the administration is in talks with several universities, and as mass starvation threatens Gaza, Israel continues to deny the crisis as France recognizes the state of Palestine. WPFW's Noah Portner has more.
Yesterday, in a surprise announcement on X, French President Emmanuel Macron stated that France would be recognizing a state of Palestine in September. France is the first G7 nation to recognize Palestine and the only Western UN Security Council member, the Security Council being crucial to the formation of modern Israel. France's diplomatic realignment is sure to anger Israel, and it serves as a denouncement of the horrible conditions Gazans are forced into. The hunger crisis in particular has rapidly accelerated over the past few days. Over 100 people have reportedly died of starvation, including 9 in the past day. Aid groups warn that doctors and even aid workers are also starving to death and unable to do their jobs, and that without interference, thousands of people may soon be starving to death every day. The Israeli government has steadfastly insisted that there is no mass famine in Gaza and that any starvation is a result of Hamas's actions. Images of emaciated